Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 4th Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19, Omicron has not swamped hospitals, by Meg Wingerter. COVID-19, FDA expands Pfizer boosters for more teens, by Lauren Neergard. Denver Area King Supers, union members vote to okay strike, by Judith Kohler. Kelly Turner, mom pleads guilty in death of daughter, 7, by Shelley Bradbury. And following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19, Omicron has not swamped hospitals. Colorado reports more than 50,000 new cases in week, a 24% positivity rate, by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. Since the fast-spreading new Omicron variant is less severe than the once-dominant Delta, Colorado's current COVID-19 situation is precarious rather than catastrophic. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment reported 50,974 new coronavirus infections statewide in the week ending Sunday, a 75% increase over the prior week, and a tally that blows past the state's single-week record of 37,804 set in November 2020. About 24% of COVID-19 tests taken in Colorado came back positive over the last week. That's worse than in April 2020, when it was difficult to get tested if you hadn't traveled to China, and indicates the virus is even more widespread than the skyrocketing case numbers would indicate. If Omicron were as likely to cause severe illness as the Delta variant, the unprecedented case surge since Christmas would have led to a devastating wave of hospitalizations, said Beth Carlton, an associate professor of environmental and occupational health at the Colorado School of Public Health. Colorado's current hospital capacity is tight, but not completely overwhelmed. As of Monday afternoon, 1,167 people were hospitalized statewide with confirmed COVID-19. A 17% increase since Christmas, the day the state's month-long drop in virus hospitalizations came to an end. About 93% of both intensive care and general hospital beds were in use Monday. Overall, most patients in Colorado hospitals are being treated for something other than the virus, but there isn't much room to spare if COVID-19 hospitalizations continue to increase. One bit of good news is that ventilator use is down, indicating people hospitalized with COVID-19 in the current wave generally aren't as sick as those in previous surges, Carlton said. People in public health are also trying to get better data on whether more of the people were hospitalized for something other than the virus and happened to test positive than in previous waves, as was seen in South Africa, she said. I remain concerned about hospital capacity, but I'm less concerned than I was a few weeks ago, she said. Children's Hospital Colorado reported it has seen many incidental admissions where the patient comes in for something else, but also is dealing with an increase in hospitalizations for COVID-19. It's not clear what the situation is in Colorado hospitals serving adult patients. While Omicron is causing more breakthrough infections among vaccinated people, the data suggests those who have had a booster shot or had their second shot less than 6 months ago are well protected against severe disease, Carlton said. The unvaccinated face the greatest risk, she said. The vaccines and boosters are not perfect, but they are an extremely effective tool. On Monday, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized a third dose of the Pfizer vaccine for kids ages 12 to 15 and allowed them to get it 5 months after their second shot. People 16 and older who received the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine were told to wait 6 months. The FDA also said younger children with compromised immune systems could get a third Pfizer dose 4 weeks after their second dose. The Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines aren't yet authorized for children. The state's COVID-19 modeling team hasn't released projections for the current surge, but did post a statement on Monday urging the public to get vaccinated, wear masks in public, limit social interactions indoors, and stay home if they aren't feeling well. While any individual's risk of becoming seriously ill is lower with Omicron than with Delta, the sheer number of people infected means that even if a smaller percentage need hospital beds, it could overwhelm an already strained system. The highly infectious nature of this variant means that this wave could be shorter, but also could be more severe than prior waves, the statement said. We are most concerned about unvaccinated and immunocompromised individuals who face the greatest risk of severe COVID-19 due to Omicron infection. In South Africa, Omicron took off like a rocket, then promptly crashed. It's not clear if the same thing will happen in the United States, though, which has very different demographics. Experts are watching the United Kingdom because the American experience with COVID-19 has generally mirrored the British one. The variant has caused significant disruption nationwide. While canceled flights are the most visible effect, some cities have reported trouble providing basic services because so many firefighters and police officers are out sick, according to the Associated Press. While most people who are infected don't become seriously ill, it's a problem for society if large numbers of people are unable to work, Carlton said. Less severe doesn't mean we should all go get infected, she said. COVID-19. FDA expands Pfizer boosters for more teens, by Lauren Neergaard, the Associated Press. The U.S. is expanding COVID-19 boosters as it confronts the Omicron surge, with the Food and Drug Administration allowing extra Pfizer shots for children as young as 12. Boosters already are recommended for everyone 16 and older, and federal regulators on Monday decided they are also warranted for 12 to 15-year-olds once enough time has passed since their last dose. But the move, coming as classes restart after the holidays, isn't the final step. A panel to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is expected to decide later this week whether to recommend boosters for the younger teens, with a final decision by Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the CDC's director. The FDA also said everyone 12 and older who's eligible for a Pfizer booster can get one as early as 5 months after their last dose rather than 6 months. FDA vaccine chief Dr. Peter Marks said even though serious illness is uncommon in younger teens, a booster will help them avoid that risk, while also helping reduce the spread of Omicron or any other coronavirus mutant. Hopefully, this will be not just a call for people to go get their booster shot, but for the tens of millions of unvaccinated Americans to rethink that choice, Marks said. It's not too late to start to get vaccinated. The FDA based its latest booster decision largely on real-world data from Israel that found no new safety concerns when 6,300 12 to 15-year-olds got a Pfizer booster 5 months after their second dose. Likewise, the FDA said even more data from Israel showed no problems with giving anyone eligible for a Pfizer booster that extra dose a month sooner than the 6 months that until now has been U.S. policy. The chief safety question for younger teens is a rare side effect called myocarditis, a type of heart inflammation seen mostly in younger men and teen boys who get either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines. The vast majority of cases are mild, far milder than the heart inflammation caused by COVID-19, and they seem to peak in older teens, the 16 and 17-year-olds. Marks said the side effect occurs in about 1 in 10,000 men and boys ages 16 to 30 after their second shot, but that a third dose appears less risky by about a third. That's probably because more time has passed before the booster than between the first two shots, he said. While the FDA didn't consult its independent scientific advisors before making that decision, the CDC's own advisory panel is sure to closely weigh how much benefit this age group is likely to get before backing the extra shot. Vaccines still offer strong protection against serious illness from any type of COVID-19. But health authorities are urging everyone who's eligible to get a booster dose for their best chance at avoiding milder breakthrough infections from the highly contagious Omicron mutant. Children tend to suffer less serious illness from COVID-19 than adults, but child hospitalizations are rising during the Omicron wave, most of them unvaccinated. Pediatrician and global health expert Dr. Philip Landrigan of Boston College welcomed the FDA's decisions, but stressed that the main need is to get the unvaccinated their first shots. It is among unvaccinated people that most of the severe illness and death from COVID will occur in coming weeks, he said in an email. Many thousands of lives could be saved if people could persuade themselves to get vaccinated. The vaccine made by Pfizer and its partner BioNTech is the only U.S. option for children of any age. About 13.5 million 12 to 17-year-olds, just more than half that age group, have received two Pfizer shots, according to the CDC. The older teens, 16 and 17-year-olds, became eligible for boosters in early December. But original vaccinations opened for the younger teens, those 12 to 15, back in May. That means those first in line in the spring, potentially millions, are about as many months past their last dose as the slightly older teens. As for even younger children, kid-sized doses for 5 to 11-year-olds rolled out more recently, in November. And experts say healthy youngsters should be protected after their second dose for a while. But the FDA also said Monday that if children that young have severely weakened immune systems, they will be allowed a third dose 28 days after their second. That's the same third dose timing already recommended for immune-compromised teens and adults. Pfizer is studying its vaccine in even smaller doses for children younger than 5. What about timing of boosters for adults who got the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson vaccines? The FDA said it didn't have any new data from Moderna to back a timing change, and people who had already had two Moderna shots should continue to wait 6 months for a booster. As for people who originally got the single-dose J&J shot, the U.S. already recommends another dose of any vaccine 2 months later. Denver Area King Supers, union members vote to okay strike, by Judith Kohler, the Denver Post. Denver area union members have voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike against supermarket chain King Supers, which is in the middle of contentious contract negotiations with United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7. King Supers responded Monday by saying it is filing a complaint of unfair labor practices against the union and its president, Kim Cordova, and charges of unlawful conduct. Union members at 88 stores voted Sunday for a strike on claims of unfair labor practices. King Super employees in Colorado Springs were voting Monday on whether to authorize a strike. The earliest employees would walk off their jobs is Sunday, a day after the union's contracts with King Supers expire. King Supers and City Market, both owned by Cincinnati-based Kroger Company and Albertsons, which owns Albertsons and Safeway stores in Colorado, are negotiating new contracts with the UFCW Local 7. Cordova said both grocery chains' proposed concessions are unacceptable, especially at a time when the grocery chains have posted huge profits and employees have risked their health, working through the coronavirus pandemic. Last week, the UFCW Local 7 filed a lawsuit against King Soopers, accusing the company of unfair labor practices, such as using third-party staffing agencies for union-covered work. These allegations are just that, allegations, as King Soopers City Market has followed the law and has not received any notice of wrongdoing from the National Labor Relations Board, King Soopers spokeswoman Jessica Trowbridge said in an email. As it relates to our labor contract, we are focused on negotiating in good faith, a contract that puts more money in our associates' pockets. King Soopers proposed new spending on wages, health care, and pension plans, including $145 million in pay increases over 4 years. The company said its offer would boost more than 75% of the employee's average hourly wage to over $18, with more than 50% making over $20 an hour on average. But the union rejected that proposal last week, saying the company's statement to employees and media on the investments didn't mention the concessions, such as higher health care premiums, that employees would have to accept. King Soopers proposals opposed by the union include capping the amount of sick leave employees can take in a year to 48 hours and the amount of sick leave they can accrue to 96 hours over a lifetime. Another proposal would pay overtime for more than 40 hours a week rather than the current policy of paying overtime for more than 8 hours a day. Other issues are pay, what the union says is inadequate staffing, and safety. Denver employees have overwhelmingly voted to strike. Today, there will be voting in Colorado Springs, where we can expect very similar results, Cordova said in a statement. The UFCW Local 7 said 98% of the Denver area retail employees voted Sunday to authorize a strike. 97% of the Denver area meat workers backed to strike. And 100% of the retail and meat workers in Parker and Boulder voted for a strike. Last week, a King Soopers spokeswoman acknowledged the company was making preparations to hire temporary replacement workers in case of a strike. A sign for replacements was posted Monday inside a King Superstore on South Colorado Boulevard in Denver. The union represents about 21,000 grocery employees in Colorado and Wyoming. It is negotiating separately with Kroger, the largest supermarket chain in the state and the U.S., and Albertsons Companies, which acquired Safeway in 2015. The last strike by grocery workers in Colorado was in 1996. Union members at King Soopers walked off the job, and Safeway and Albertsons eventually locked out union members. The strike lasted 42 days. Kelly Turner, Mom Pleads Guilty in Death of Daughter, 7, by Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. The Colorado mother accused of murdering her 7-year-old daughter by pretending the girl was terminally ill pleaded guilty Monday to child abuse that negligently caused her daughter's death. Kelly Turner, 43, put her head in her hands and wept when District Court Judge Patricia Heron asked how she wished to plead. Turner's public defender put a hand on Turner's back and spoke with her quietly. The mother paused for nearly a minute before responding to the judge's query. Guilty, Turner finally answered, pleading to the charge of committing child abuse and negligently causing 7-year-old Olivia Gant's death. She went on to plead guilty to 2 theft charges as well. Turner was charged in 2019 with first-degree murder in Olivia's death. Prosecutors accused Turner of portraying her daughter as sick for years, lying about her symptoms and fooling doctors at Children's Hospital Colorado into providing unnecessary and even life-threatening procedures. The girl died in hospice care in 2017. A first-degree murder conviction carries a mandatory life sentence in Colorado. Turner pleaded guilty to lesser charges. As part of the plea agreement, prosecutors and Turner agreed to a 16-year prison sentence on the child abuse charge. Turner would serve that prison term at the same time as a 10-year sentence on one of the theft charges and a 3-year sentence on the final theft charge, Heron said during Monday's hearing. The judge will have the option to accept the plea agreement and impose that agreed-on sentence at a February 9th sentencing hearing. On Monday, she called the agreement difficult to stomach. "That does not mean I will not impose it," she said. "For any number of reasons, I understand how we end up here. But it's difficult when we have the death of a young child, a death after what the court considers from my review of the documents, after this child had been submitted to a lifetime of painful, frightening tests and surgical procedures, ultimately resulting in this child's death. It is unthinkable, and from this court's perspective, generally would be met with the harshest of sentences." Chief Deputy District Attorney Christopher Gallo told Herron that the case was extremely complex and that prosecutors couldn't pinpoint a discrete moment in time when the abuse happened. Olivia's medical saga stretched for years. He said that doesn't cripple the prosecution, but still complicates any theory of conviction we would proceed on in trial. "This is not perfect justice by any means," Gallo said. "But certainly, Judge, this plea is in the interest of justice. And for those reasons, we ask the court to accept the plea." One of Turner's public defenders, Ara Ohanian, told the judge Monday that defense attorneys spent many, many hours working with prosecutors to craft what would be the best thing to do in this case. A Denver Post investigation last year found that some doctors and nurses at Children's Hospital Colorado raised concerns that Olivia was being medically abused by her mother before Olivia died, but the hospital did not report their suspicions to any outside agencies. The hospital instead relied on an internal team to look into the concerns, which then concluded that there was no need to alert the state's Department of Human Services, despite the state's mandatory reporting laws. Olivia's death went uninvestigated for more than a year, until Turner brought Olivia's sister into the hospital for vague medical complaints, and a doctor realized Turner was lying about the girl's medical history. Olivia's surviving family members in September resolved a $25 million civil claim against the hospital. Holland Hoskins, an attorney who represents Olivia's family, said some family members plan to speak at Turner's sentencing. "Olivia's family remains completely heartbroken over her tragic and preventable death. They want everyone to know that Olivia was an amazing and resilient young girl," Hoskins said. "They intend to speak at sentencing as their mission remains to make sure this never happens to another child." Marshall Fire. Thousands displaced scramble for housing. Organizations work to connect residents with homes in tight market. By Noel Phillips and Joe Rubino, The Denver Post. Michael and Deanne Pickle are living in a residence inn in Broomfield. Deborah Mordecai has been sleeping on her daughter's couch. Her 24-year-old son is staying at a friend's house. Cousins welcome Gladys Forshee into their Loveland home. And Patrick Kilbride has a niece to thank for allowing him to stay at her house in Ken Carroll. All were displaced on Thursday when the Marshall Fire swept through Superior and Louisville, destroying more than 900 homes and displacing thousands of people. Now the Pickles, Mordecai, Forshee, and Kilbride are among the thousands searching for housing while they figure out how or if they will rebuild their homes. Forshee, 80, planned to look at a condominium on Monday afternoon. "If that doesn't work out, I don't know," she said about her future housing. She lost a house that her family has owned in Old Town Superior for more than 50 years, and she doesn't plan to rebuild it. The depth of the need is profound. Some 991 structures were destroyed by the fire and another 127 were damaged, the Boulder County Sheriff's Office reported over the weekend. In some cases, like Superior Sagamore Subdivision, entire neighborhoods were burned away. Officials have not said exactly how many people the destruction displaced, but government agencies and a real estate organization are mobilizing as quickly as they can to fill the breach in a community where housing already is in short supply. Armanda DeVito Parley and Shannon Schleip launched the Marshall Fire Housing Needs and Availability Facebook page on Friday morning. The two friends are both realtors with RE/MAX Alliance. Parley is based in Arvada and Schleip in Aurora. The page is set up to be a meeting place for people with immediate housing needs because of the fire and people with space available. By Monday afternoon, the page had more than 1,600 members. Among the dozens of posts were many offering spaces at no charge. The page was inspired by 2020's historic East Troublesome Fire. Schleip's in-laws and several friends lost their homes in Grand Lake to that disaster. More than a year later, Schleip said she only knows two people who have been able to rebuild and move back into the community. She knows some Marshall Fire evacuees are facing a multi-year process. One of the big things with the recovery up there was trying to help people get into long-term housing, Schleip said. Down here, especially with the market the way it is and the limited inventory we have, it's going to be really, really tough for people to find more permanent housing. A week ago, on December 27th, there were just 1,950 single-family homes and 913 condos listed for sale in the entire Denver metro, Parley said. That was everything available from Longmont in the north to Castle Rock in the south and Evergreen in the west to Parker in the east. As of Monday, those numbers had dwindled to 1,576 homes and 571 condos available on the region's multiple listing service. The rental and for sale housing markets could get even more strained, Parley said. I think initially you're going to see rents skyrocket, and that's just short-term rents, she said. I think you're going to see a real desperation on the part of home buyers. On Monday, hundreds of people streamed into an office complex in Lafayette to visit the Boulder County Disaster Assistance Center and a FEMA Disaster Recovery Center. Almost every major home insurer also set up tents and mobile offices in the complex parking lot. People filled insurance claims and registered for federal assistance while also picking up food, pet supplies, COVID-19 test kits, and other necessities. As of Sunday night, more than 450 people had filed for FEMA assistance, said John Huss, Deputy Federal Coordinating Officer for the Marshall Fire. He encouraged everyone affected by the fire to register for FEMA assistance, even if they were unsure of their needs. There's going to be a great need for housing in this area, Huss said. Federal, state, and local authorities are still figuring out what exactly will be done to ease the housing crunch, he said. When asked whether FEMA trailers, such as those used after Hurricane Katrina, will be deployed, Huss said it was too early to know whether that would be an appropriate tool in this community. FEMA offers up to $37,000 per household to help people with repairs and rental assistance, he said. The U.S. Small Business Administration offers disaster loans to businesses and individuals, said Rick Tillery, an agency spokesman. Those loans are available to homeowners and renters who need to replace real estate and personal property, including cars, he said. The Colorado Apartment Association stood up a rental housing directory for fire victims over the weekend. Available at caahq.org/.available-apartments-4-displaced-families. The directory has pages of results, all of which are ready for people to move in immediately, according to a news release Saturday. Our rental housing market is tight, and it may be difficult for displaced residents to find housing quickly, Drew Hamrick, the association's general counsel, said in a statement. We're hoping this directory can make a big difference for the Marshall Fire's victims, helping them identify units in their communities available today. The results on the website span the metro area. The Boulder Area Rental Housing Association has its own website with housing available closer to the burn zone. Those listings are online at barhaonline.org/available-properties-4-displaced-tenants. The Boulder Association has been working with local real estate agents and groups, including the Red Cross, the University of Colorado Boulder, and the Boulder Chamber of Commerce, to get the word out to people in need, according to Saturday's news release. The Pickles fled so fast on Thursday that they left with only the clothes on their backs. On Monday, Michael Pickles' donated blue jeans were being cinched around his waist with the bungee cord as he met with all state representatives at the FEMA center. The night they evacuated, the couple found a room at a Residence Inn in Denver, but they wanted to be closer to Michael Pickles' job at a Walmart, so they moved to a Residence Inn in Broomfield. For now, insurance will cover the expense. But Deanne Pickles said she knows it is not a long-term solution for them or for Allstate. Their insurance policy covers up to 24 months of temporary housing, she said. They said they would help us try to find something semi-close to our work, Michael Pickles said, but he worried that semi-close would be miles away, forcing a long commute while they rebuild their home in Old Town Superior. We hope we don't end up in Denver, Deanne Pickles said with a sense of dread. The Colorado Association of Realtors Foundation is raising money that can be used to ease the burdens on fire victims, said Amy McDermott, the charity's executive director. The foundation plans to provide between $25,000 and $50,000 from its endowment fund and combine that with money raised from real estate agents, brokerages, other individuals and businesses, and the broader Colorado Association of Realtors to provide multiple avenues of help. Some of the money will be packaged into grants for organizations on the ground, helping victims with housing, and some will go directly to people who lost their homes to fund things like mortgage and rental assistance, McDermott said. She expects to provide more details about the application process for that support at coloradorealtors.com/about-car/foundation by the end of the week. Everything is mobilizing quite quickly, which is fantastic, McDermott said. Mordecai showed pictures of her home on her cell. It is still standing, while her neighbors' houses are pits of ash and burned metal. I'm so blessed, she said. Although the house has been declared structurally sound and she and her 24-year-old son have been able to go inside to retrieve belongings, it is uninhabitable because of the ash, smoke, and water damage. The house also does not have electricity or water. She said almost every house that was left intact has ash inside and smells like smoke. Her daughter's Louisville townhome is livable, but there is a thin film of ash throughout, she said. There's not a person you're going to talk to that doesn't have that, Mordecai said. Her insurance company will pay for temporary housing until an adjuster and a fire remediation specialist figure out what it will take to make it safe to live in. She was looking for a hotel room for Monday night because sleeping on couches already was becoming tiresome. She was picking up her son from a friend's because we need to decompress their household. It's a little too much. Kilbride found a spare room at Anissa's house in Ken Carroll, but now his commute to work at McGuckin Hardware in Boulder is more than 70 miles round trip. He plans to stay with friends in Boulder until he finds a more long-term solution as he waits to rebuild, but he isn't sure what that will be. As for his home in Old Town Superior, Kilbride is thinking he might sell one of the two lots he owns and build a tiny house. Before the fire, he lived in a 1,400-square-foot house with his dog, Roscoe, and cat, Dusty. Both pets perished in the fire. You never get enough money back from these people to rebuild, he said. You usually downgrade, you know? Marshall Fire, more access coming to burn area, by Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. 4 days after the Marshall Fire rampage through Boulder County, authorities are still searching for two missing people, while more and more residents and business owners are being allowed back into the burn area to inspect the damage. Downtown Superior, Discovery Park, Spanish Hills, and Original Town, excluding the Sagamore subdivision, have been reopened to residents, the Boulder Office of Emergency Management said in a news release Monday night. Superior Marketplace and businesses in the area west of McCaslin Boulevard will be accessible to employees and contractors only, officials said. Businesses in the area east of McCaslin Boulevard will remain closed, with the exception of Sports Stable and Urgent Care. In neighboring Louisville, town officials are implementing a pass system for residents to access homes and businesses behind the soft closure roadblocks. Police Chief Dave Hayes said Monday, identification will be required for individuals going to soft closure areas, but hard closure areas remain closed. Pelley also confirmed that the investigation into what started the 6,219-acre wildfire on Thursday includes the 12 tribes compound and surrounding area, but declined to give additional details, saying it could take a while for the cause to be determined. Investigators have already interviewed dozens of people with the help of the FBI, he said. The stakes are huge, Pelley said. Witnesses told the Denver Post on Sunday that investigators have frequented the 12 Tribes property, home to a Christian religious sect, near Colorado 93 and Marshall Road in recent days. Xcel Energy reported Monday that 400 customers are still without electricity in the burn area, while the company has restored natural gas to 5,000 of the 13,000 people whose service was disrupted in the area. The company has handed out 20,000 space heaters as it works to restore the utilities, said Alice Jackson, president of Xcel Energy Colorado. Boulder County authorities urged those affected by the fire to go to the Disaster Assistance Center, 1755 South Public Road in Lafayette, between 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. to receive myriad services, including mental and public health services, housing assistance, and help with Federal Emergency Management Agency aid and insurance. The recovery will be open 7 days a week for at least a few weeks, officials said. Those seeking services can also go to boco.org/Marshall Fire. Recovery is a marathon, not a sprint, said Gary Sanfracone, Boulder County's disaster recovery manager, urging those affected to focus on self-care and returning to daily activities and hobbies as they cope with the fire's aftermath. The Marshall Fire, spurred by hurricane-force winds and bone-dry conditions exacerbated by climate change, tore through Superior, Louisville, and unincorporated Boulder County on Thursday, destroying nearly 1,000 homes and businesses. The fire is the most destructive wildfire in state history. Officials previously said they feared the two missing people have died, while a third person initially reported missing was found Sunday. This is going to be a long road back for many families, Governor Jared Polis said at Monday's news conference. Emergency officials warned returning residents in soft closure zones to stay on their own property and not to wander into other areas under a hard closure, which are open only to emergency personnel. Returning residents should also bring bottled water, as there is no potable water in the affected area, officials said. Donations. Restaurants, bars, and shops are hosting fundraisers for Marshall Fire Relief efforts by Tiny Riccardi, the Denver Post. The Marshall Fire in Boulder County is the most destructive wildfire in Colorado's history, according to state officials, having burned more than 6,000 acres and damaged or destroyed upward of 1,000 buildings. It will take time to rebuild after the devastation, but there are ways to help in the interim, such as donating money to the Boulder County Wildfire Fund, the American Red Cross of Colorado, or one of the numerous GoFundMe campaigns benefiting victims. The businesses listed below also have committed to donating a portion of proceeds to wildfire relief efforts. So if you're looking to shop, eat, or drink to help victims of the fires, stop by one of these places. Where to find Marshall Fire fundraisers? Dozens of restaurants in Boulder, Denver, and the surrounding areas are offering free meals to those displaced by the Marshall Fire under an initiative called Restaurants Revive. Visit BoulderDowntown.com boulder-fire-response-resources for a list of participating eateries. A sampling includes Act Eat Serve, Atomic Chicken, Bar Taco, My Neighbor Felix, Ska Street, Wahoo's Fish Tacos, and more. Blake Street Tavern in Denver is collecting donations, including water, blankets, toiletries, and other items. The organization Colorado Law Enforcement Officer Wives is selling Colorado Strong t-shirts with 100% of the proceeds to benefit the Boulder County Wildlife Fund and the Colorado Fraternal Order of Police. The Empire Lounge and Restaurant in Louisville is serving free takeout meals, soup, and bread to anyone displaced by the fire January 5th through the 9th. Distribution starts at noon. The restaurant will serve 250 meals per day. From now until January 7th, Gunther Tootie's restaurant is donating 10% of sales at its locations in Thornton and Denver to the Boulder Wildlife Fund. At Lady Justice Brewing Company, $1 from every pint of Sandra Day IPA that's ordered in January will be donated to the Boulder County Wildlife Fund. Linger Restaurant in Denver is hosting a pop-up fundraiser on January 4th from 4 to 9 p.m. when chefs will be cooking up a specialty takeout menu with proceeds to benefit those impacted by the fire. Takeout items include bao buns, fresh rolls, cocktails to go, and more. Highlands Ranch-based sign maker Marco Brothers Legacy is donating 50% of sales now until January 7th to the Boulder County Wildfire Fund. From January 5th to 11th, The Sink restaurant in Boulder will donate 10% of sales to the Boulder County Wildlife Fund. Denver's Tivoli Brewing Company is donating 100% of proceeds from bar and restaurant sales between now and January 10th to relief efforts. Additionally, the brewery and restaurant is offering a free meal and beer to first responders who present their IDs. The nonprofit We Don't Waste is hosting its first mobile food market of the year on January 4th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. at 2545 East 40th Avenue in Denver. The organization will distribute free food, and anyone is welcome to attend. Is your business hosting a fundraiser for victims of the wildfires? Email Tiny Riccardi, C-R-I-C-C-I-A-R-D-I at denverpost.com to have your event added to this list, which will be continuously updated online. Some courts suspend jury trials again. Jury trials were suspended Monday in several courts across Metro Denver because of the danger posed by the highly contagious Omicron variant of COVID-19. Jury trials will not happen in Boulder, Jefferson, Broomfield, Adams, Arapahoe, Douglas, Elbert, and Lincoln counties until at least January 21st, if not longer. Chief judges for those judicial districts decided Monday. Denver's courts did not immediately follow suit. Most courts in the state suspended jury trials during the start of the pandemic in 2020, citing the danger of having large groups of prospective jurors gathered inside, but jury trials resumed in 2021. The unprecedented stoppage of jury trials created a massive backlog of criminal cases that some in the justice system thought would take years to dig out from. The suspension in the 18th Judicial District comes as the area sees the fastest spread of COVID-19 at any point in the pandemic. Chief Judge Michelle Amico wrote an order that took effect Monday. Amico wrote in her order for the 18th Judicial District that she would continue to closely monitor the spread of the Omicron variant and change the order as needed. This was by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. 17-vehicle crash briefly closes I-70. Interstate 70 was closed in both directions through Glenwood Canyon for more than 2 hours Monday morning due to a 17-vehicle crash on the highway, according to the Colorado State Patrol. Both directions of I-70 through the canyon reopened just before 2 p.m. 15 cars and 2 commercial motor vehicles were involved in the crash, officials said. Emergency crews were on scene working to clear the incident, CSP said. The closure was between exits 116, Glenwood Springs, and 133, Dutzero, according to the Colorado Department of Transportation. Photos tweeted by CSP showed a mashup of vehicles facing different directions and slick ice on the interstate. This was by Elizabeth Hernandez, the Denver Post. Airlines, more flights canceled, delayed by thousands, by David Koning and Matt O'Brien, the Associated Press. A winter storm that hit the mid-Atlantic on Monday, combined with pandemic-caused shortages of airline workers, to push flight cancellations to a holiday season high, creating more frustration for travelers just trying to get home. More than 3,000 U.S. flights and about 4,800 worldwide were canceled by late afternoon Monday on the East Coast, according to tracking service FlightAware. Another 13,000 flights were delayed, including more than 6,000 in the U.S. Travelers could take hope from an improving weather forecast. Airlines had canceled fewer than 400 U.S. flights scheduled for Tuesday. First, however, they had to contend with a winter storm that dumped several inches of snow on the District of Columbia, Northern Virginia, and Central Maryland. The cancellations and delays added to the despair felt over the weekend by holiday travelers trying to get home. Jason Privet was stuck at the Atlanta airport for 8 hours and counting by Monday evening, trying to get home to Virginia after spending the holidays with his family in Tampa, Florida. He was growing increasingly anxious about the risk of COVID-19 transmission in the terminal. American Airlines canceled Pivot's original flight to Washington's Reagan National Airport long before a winter storm system hit the Washington area Monday. He rebooked on Delta Airlines, but got hit with more cancellations after a stopover in Atlanta, this time clearly due to the storm. There is just never a reason given for anything. That's my biggest issue, said the 28-year-old who works for an accounting company. Many other travelers tweeted at the airlines to complain about last-minute cancellations and long delays, lost bags, and hours-long hold times to reach anybody in customer service. Some said they slept in airports. The toll of grounded flights in the U.S. was in the few hundreds per day the week before Christmas, then soared past 1,000 a day. Airlines blamed crew shortages on the spreading virus, including the highly transmissible Omicron variant. New cases tripled over the past 2 weeks, according to figures from Johns Hopkins University. Airlines and passengers lucked out for several days with mostly favorable weather, but that changed when the winter storm hit the Midwest on Saturday and caused cancellations to spike again to new holiday season highs. Over the weekend, about 5,400 U.S. flights were canceled, nearly 12% of all scheduled flights, and more than 9,000 worldwide, according to FlightAware. By Monday afternoon, about 18,000 U.S. flights have been canceled since Christmas Eve. Many of the cancellations were made hours or even a day in advance. Airlines believe they have a better chance to keep lighter schedules on track, and it saves passengers from making needless trips to the airport. More than three-quarters of Monday's scheduled flights at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport and nearly half of those at nearby Baltimore Washington International Thurgood Marshall Airport were scrubbed, according to FlightAware. Both airports received more than 6 inches of snow. Southwest Airlines had canceled about 600 flights, or 17% of Monday's schedule, by midday. Spokesman Brad Hawkins said storms over the weekend and on Monday affected operations at some of its biggest airports, including Chicago, Denver, and Baltimore, and left planes and crews out of position. United Airlines said the nationwide COVID-19 spike caused by the Omicron variant has affected its flight crews, resulting in canceled flights. Delta cited winter weather and Omicron, but said it expected fewer than half as many cancellations Tuesday and Wednesday. New York Attorney General Trump, Ivanka, Don Jr. subpoenaed in probe, by Michael R. Sisak, The Associated Press, Byline, New York. The New York Attorney General's office confirmed Monday that it has subpoenaed former President Donald Trump and his two eldest children, Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr., demanding their testimony in an investigation into the family's business practices. Attorney General Letitia James's office said in a court filing that it recently issued subpoenas seeking testimony and documents from the Trumps as part of a years-long civil probe involving matters including the valuation of properties owned or controlled by Trump and his company. Monday's filing, made public as James went to court in a bid to enforce the subpoena, was the first time that investigators publicly disclose that they are also seeking information from Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr., both trusted allies of their father, who've been executives in his family's Trump organization. Last month, it was reported James's office had requested Trump sit for a deposition. Lawyers for the Trumps filed court papers Monday evening seeking to block the subpoenas, calling them an unprecedented and unconstitutional maneuver, and accusing James of attempting to obtain testimony that could then be used against the Trumps in a parallel criminal investigation being overseen by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. James seeks to circumvent the entire grand jury process and nullify the Trumps' rights by forcing them to testify without the immunity that's guaranteed under state law if they were subpoenaed to testify in front of the grand jury in the criminal probe, the Trumps' lawyers wrote. James, a Democrat, has spent more than 2 years looking at whether the Trump Organization misled banks or tax officials about the value of assets, inflating them to gain favorable loan terms or minimizing them to reap tax savings. Despite their names, they must play by the same rules as everyone else. These delay tactics will not stop us from following the facts of the law, which is why we will be asking the court to compel Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump to testify with our office under oath, James said in a statement after the Trumps moved to block the subpoenas. The dispute over the subpoenas had played out in secret until Monday, when a judge who had handled other subpoena fights arising from the Trump investigation agreed to entertain arguments over the new subpoenas. The court filing from James's office was then posted to the public court docket. The judge, Arthur Engoron, previously sided with James on other matters related to the probe, including making another Trump son, Trump Organization executive Eric Trump, testify after his lawyers abruptly canceled a scheduled deposition. Last month, Trump sued James in federal court, seeking to put an end to her investigation. Trump, in the lawsuit, claimed that the attorney general had violated the Republicans' constitutional rights. The ex-president has decried James's investigation as part of a witch hunt, along with a parallel criminal probe being run by the Manhattan District Attorney's office. Filibuster. Schumer, Senate to vote on change, by Lisa Mascaro, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. Days before the anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced the Senate will vote on filibuster rules changes to advance stalled voting legislation that Democrats say is needed to protect democracy. In a letter Monday to colleagues, Schumer, a Democrat of New York, said the Senate must evolve and will debate and consider the rules changes by January 17th, on or before Martin Luther King Jr. Day, as the Democrats seek to overcome Republican opposition to their elections law package. Let me be clear. January 6th was a symptom of a broader illness, an effort to delegitimize our election process, Schumer wrote, and the Senate must advance systemic democracy reforms to repair our republic, or else the events of that day will not be an aberration. They will be the new norm. The election and voting rights package has been stalled in the evenly split 50-50 Senate, blocked by a Republican-led filibuster and leaving Democrats unable to mount the 60-vote threshold needed to advance it toward passage. Democrats have been unable to agree among themselves over potential changes to the Senate rules to reduce the 60-vote hurdle, despite months of private negotiations. Two holdout Democrats, Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, have tried to warn their party off changes to the Senate rules, arguing that if and when Republicans take majority control of the chamber, they could lose the lower voting threshold to advance bills Democrats oppose. President Joe Biden has waded cautiously into the debate. A former senator who largely stands by existing rules, but is also under enormous political pressure to break the logjam on the voting legislation. how the Senate rules would be changed remains under discussion. Voting rights advocates warn Republican-led states are passing election legislation and trying to install elections officials loyal to former President Donald Trump in ways that could subvert future elections. Trump urged his followers last January 6 to fight like hell for his presidency, and a mob stormed the Capitol trying to stop Congress from certifying the state election tallies for Biden. It was the worst domestic attack on the seat of government in U.S. history. From Denver Post Wire Services, ex-Theranos CEO is guilty of fraud and conspiracy, byline San Jose, California. A jury found fallen Silicon Valley star Elizabeth Holmes guilty of fraud for turning her blood testing startup Theranos into a sophisticated sham, one that duped billionaires and other unwitting investors into backing a seemingly revolutionary company whose medical technology never worked as Holmes promised. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.